episode of Data Protection Made Easy podcast with us data protection people. My name is Ollie Ray. I'm your host for this session. I'm joined now, for purposes of this introduction, by my esteemed colleague, Miles Dacres. Hello, Miles.
Hi, Ollie. How's your Friday going?
It's all right. It's all right. Much better now that we've just had what I think was a brilliant session.
It was very good. Lots of engagement for everybody. Yeah, great session.
Very much so. Some very broad-ranging topics this week. We talked about all sorts. We had a lot of interaction about SARs made through social media or third-party platforms. That was an interesting one. The applicability of the Freedom of Information Act to private communication channels. That generated a lot of engagement. We also spoke at length about the role of the DPO, which is obviously good for us. Can't complain on that front. But yeah, no, good session, I thought. Plenty of interaction, as you say, Miles. And yeah, it was a really good one on this lovely sunny afternoon.
Was indeed, Ollie. Was indeed.
Lovely stuff. Well, I tell you what, instead of waffling about it, why don't we let the listener get stuck into this latest episode? As ever, if you want an invite to the live session, you can reach out to any of us, but failing that, support at Data Protection People with any questions or if you want an invite. Do come along. They're really good fun and a really good space for exchanging ideas and sharing some insights. And they're really excellent. The topic next week, we're looking back on 6 years of DPP in the social housing sector, which should be excellent. You know, we've got some really fantastic insights over that time. So I'm really looking forward to that one. And if you'd like to come along to one of these open surgery type sessions, the GDPR radios, then we'll be running one the week thereafter. It's every other week that we run them. So anything else to report, Miles, before we get stuck in?
No, that sounds perfect, Ollie.
Cool. Well, in that case, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Phil Brining, David Holmes, and myself. So generally, we like to do a little bit about what's been in the news. I've got a couple of bits, but really not very much because I've had my head down all week. So, Mr. Holmes, I'm primarily counting on you because you're normally up to speed on things.
I've got a few bits that we can kind of talk around, and do jump in if anybody's heard about them, read about them, got anything else to add, because I too have been kind of head down and trying to deliver some useful work for our clients. But the first thing I wanted to raise, I don't know if anybody's seen it, it's a European thing. But has anybody come across or heard about the Luxembourg fines?
Yes.
The Data Protection Authority over there. It's only 18,000 euros, but it's for the lack of involvement or lack of involving the DPO with resources and stuff. I thought that was rather interesting to kind of read through and to understand. Although there's an unnamed company by the DPA over in Luxembourg, they came up with a couple of points really, and they said the contact details with the DPO are difficult to access on the company's website. And that the details were only available in English, but not in any of the official languages of Luxembourg. The DPO is not involved in issues relating to data protection. Was not involved in all issues relating to data protection. And always acted upon explicit requests of the data controller. So there's possibly a query there about whether there's any kind of acting under guide or instruction. The DPO was not provided with sufficient resources to perform his duty either. And that kind of just got me thinking really about how many, even back here in the UK, I know we're outside of Europe, but it got me thinking really how many organisations have a DPO in title only. And don't necessarily ensure that the DPOs supported appropriately or even provided the or have the ability to fulfil the statutory tasks.
Well, we know from experience, Dave, that's incredibly common, isn't it? There's a lot of organisations that either have someone who's meant to be fulfilling the DPO role, but in practice is just bogged down in, you know, handling SARs or whatever it might be, so not actually involved in advising and supervising. Or conversely, it's someone who's already got a role within the business and is just doing data protection on the side. Have you got a link to that, by the way? Someone's asking in the chat.
I'll put one up.
I'm on it. I'll put one in. I saw that as well. That's interesting, yeah.
I found it quite interesting, really, because I've had conversations with some organisations where they're kind of, well, we expect the DPO to do this, and why can't the DPO do that? So I'm wondering whether, although the role of the DPO might understand what the DPO's got to do, firstly, or whether the DPO's empowered enough to stand up to the organisation and kind of going, well, actually putting me in a position of conflict by asking me to take on these particular duties. It's not coming from the point that DPO can't do additional duties, but it's making sure that the DPO is not in a position of conflict. So it's like I said, I was just more interested in that side as to whether DPOs feel conflicted. Whether the DPO is title only or expected to make more of the decisions around things as opposed to necessarily just advising and guiding.
Yeah, it's interesting. Peter's saying that it might be why the DCMS wants to get rid of DPOs. I'll tell you what, I had a very interesting conversation on something similar to this with a network of DPOs for some multi-academy trusts across the country earlier this week. It's really good to talk to them. And one of the things that one of them said was very interesting. They were talking about DPIA specifically and the process around that. And they said, well, you know, if we're not happy with the DPIA, then we put our foot down. And whatever shiny new piece of kit the member of the team wants, they can't get it until the DPIA is completed. However, a couple of sentences later, she says, however, we don't sign off on them. You know, we don't sign off on the DPIA. It's not for us to sign off on it. And I thought that was really good because that's ultimately the balance you want, isn't it, really, as a DPO, to have the authority to say, no, this isn't good enough, but also not put yourself in a position where you're signing off on things and taking ownership of them. I thought it was a really good stance to have. I've tried to apply that, but it can be difficult if you've not got the right backing.
I think it can be difficult because a lot of people, I've certainly seen situations or been in situations where with the DPIAs, where they think it needs to be signed off by the DPO, and you kind of go, what do you mean by signed off? Do you mean signed to say I've reviewed it and feel that it's happy that the decisions in there are in line with expectations? Are you using the word it's got to be signed off by DPO to say, well, actually none of this can happen unless the DPO is happy, which isn't necessarily what the requirement of the DPO is in that sense. So I think that's quite a valid point that you pick up there, Ollie.
Yes, it's interesting. Thanks for popping that link in.
Yeah,
Phil.
I put the detail 33-page deliberation from the regulator, the Luxembourg regulator, but it's in French. So, I wouldn't have thought we would want to translate 33 pages, Ollie. But I mean,
I'm not going to do that at this moment in time. I think we can think of better things to do than listen to me translate French for half an hour.
No, I was suggesting I was suggesting weekend work, but no.
I'll have a think about it. Mark, we do sort of, in that if there's anything in French, then I look at it, but that's about the extent of our translation services, basically.
To be fair, Mark, we've paid a company. We have a company in Ilkley that we pay to do translations for us, because they're a translation bureau. So we have had decision notices. I remember getting a Belgian one translated, which cost us a few hundred pounds, and then about a month later, it got published in English. So we tend to kind of hang around a bit before we start paying for translations to be done, but it can be done. And Google Translate usually does quite a reasonable job. Even on technical language, you know, but you could probably find the essence of this and get the gist of it.
I would support if you're using Google Translate to only take the essence and not the fact that Google translated exactly, it legally accurately.
Yeah,
for sure. Dave is asking, is there any guidance on what a DPO role should entail to avoid conflicts of interest? Perhaps third-party DPO a better option for many companies. I think there are European Data Protection Board guidelines, I believe, on the role of DPO.
I find those and post them as well. Yeah.
Which are quite good. But I guess that is one of the intrinsic values of being outsourced, is that you instantly have a natural separation and you're instantly more likely to avoid those conflicts of interest, aren't you? Really. So that's one of the benefits without wanting to turn this into a sales pitch.
Yes, but to counter that, you know, arguably you could say, well, you know, it's in the DPO's interest to retain the contract, you know, but you got less politics. You're not involved in the politics. You can walk away at the end of the day, you know, and to be fair, if we lose work, we lose work. But, you know, it's different from losing your job, isn't it? I think you're probably more independent as a third party, but you know, they're not entirely devoid of influence.
No, for sure. And I also find possibly, if you, as an external, the great benefits of an external DPO is you get a bit of a critical friend, that kind of thing. You're less bought in. All the bits that you've only said, but if you've got an external DPO, you're still sometimes slightly missing the eyes and the ears because you're not around the coffee machines. You're not in every meeting. You've not got the wider office environment around you necessarily as much as what you would do if you're in-house. So there's pros and cons to either, to be fair.
Yeah, you're spot on, Dave.
I'm going to stick a couple of things in the chat. One is a document that's produced by the European Commission on professional standards for data protection officers with respect to EU institutions and EU bodies. So that's quite interesting as a background read as well. Then I'll put in the guidance on the role of a DPO. So I'll put two things in, unless somebody's already done it. No, they haven't. Sorry, Ollie, I interrupted you. Carry on.
No, that's fine. Don't you worry. I was going to say, I completely agree with Dave. You know, if you're outsourced, you only need to be involved in, let's say, you know, reviewing ROPAs or in some sort of complex technical DPI, and all of a sudden, because you're not internal, it becomes very quickly apparent that you don't necessarily have the working knowledge of the business, and that can hold you back. Christina's saying that as an external DPO, rather, you're also not expected to sign off on DPIAs. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. I'm systematically asked to sign off on DPIAs, even though I'm external, by my clients, because the DPO is seen as that position, I guess. Do either of you get that much?
Well, I do, but this is what the point I was making earlier, but when they're saying sign off, what do you actually mean? Are you saying that this can't go ahead until you've put your signature on the piece of paper to approve it, or are you signing it off to say, I've read it, I've got no further comments, or I've read it and I've got additional comments to make? So it depends what you mean by the sign off in that sense. I would have said the activity can't go ahead until the DPO has signed it and approved it. I would necessarily say that wasn't my interpretation of what the law requires.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I think that's probably more of an organisational control really than anything else.
I get asked to sign off on DPAs, Ollie, and I generally push back and say, you know, I can say I've got no further comments, although usually that's caveated by, because I haven't got sufficient information, you haven't put in data flows, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we always kind of advise, we're not executive officers in the organisations that we are data protection officers in, therefore we can't, you know, instruct employees, we can't discipline people, we can only make recommendations, and we can sign off on the DPI and say, we, you know, from what it says, we don't think this represents, you know, a latent risk, or, you know, the latent risks have been adequately dealt with. So we can sign off on that respect, but ultimately, you know, if the process of the project doesn't go ahead until the external DPO has approved the DPIA, then I think that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Ultimately, you know, we're asked to advise on DPIAs, and that presumably means, you know, saying whether it's acceptable or not in terms of the DPIA. You know, I mean, the DPIA is obviously on processing activities usually. So by default, you know, if you're saying the DPIA is sufficient, robust, and well structured and addresses all the risks, then presumably the processing is until the processing or something changes.
I would also like to add there that, and this is a little tongue-in-cheek, and I do apologise about that, but there is a bit of an assumption that you're getting the DPIAs before the activity has started. I do often see DPIAs completed after the event. So it's kind of considering them being done retrospectively. So this has happened, we just need to be playing a bit of catch-up, that kind of thing. And do you mind looking at this and signing it off? And you're kind of going, this is, well, fair enough, I'll have a look. But it's kind of after the event at that point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. There's plenty of good links going in the chat. Thank you to Steph and Tom for sharing links to the Luxembourg case in English and a similar decision from Belgium as well. So thank you to you both. Interesting link that Cameron has popped in about EDPB guidelines on Article 23 restrictions. That sounds very interesting, but I have to admit that I missed that. a lot of people talking about approving DPIAs and the fact that there's a bit of a misunderstanding around that. Rob's also asking us about, just to switch topics very slightly, Rob's asking us about generic privacy policies. So he says he came across a company this week, without naming names, who use a privacy policy generator to construct something quite generic. What are our thoughts on that?
I think the idea, the concept of a privacy notice generator is a great one. If you can, which clearly this hasn't, get the level of detail in it that's required. And if, imagine your generator is asking all sorts of questions about recipients and transfers, and if there's transfers, then what's the mechanisms and where can I find the information about the transfers? But have you got a generator that provides that level of detail? Don't know.
Yeah, it's unlikely.
I would have said as long as it provided the detail, then it may help, because there can be rather laborious things to put together. But without actually seeing it and working through and seeing what an output of it would be like.
It would be great. You know, you get, in theory, it'd be great. It would standardise all the output. It would make sure that there was a database of information behind the privacy notice, so there'd be something that
could
change something. Yeah, you
could.
Well, I don't know, but that would be a good way of doing it. You know, if you change something, you know, in the ROPAs, then it could trigger an automatic refresh and redistribution of the privacy notice, given certain constraints, like this is a significant change, therefore it's got to be pushed out to all data subjects, so it's a minor change, and therefore it can just be published on the website. I think if you could build an engine that did that, it would be really useful, actually. Because
that's
it would,
the
in, that would also
for
be,
next week,
Phil. Yeah, a database of privacy notices. You know, that would also be a byproduct of it. It would be great.
No, for sure.
Yeah, but arguably, go on.
No, you got me.
No, I was just going to say, arguably, the risk, though, is that it introduces a slight degree of complacency in all of this. If this is a lovely sounding system, but if it weren't set up right, then all of a sudden, you know, you're in trouble and you're at risk of getting a bit complacent, you'd think.
I was going to say that if it's automated and it doesn't think, so there's no intelligence behind it, it's going to be subject to the old garbage in, garbage out approach, isn't it?
Yeah, it depends on. I mean, in theory, it's, you know, useful tool, but like everything, devil's in the detail, isn't it? Do a DPA on it is what I would say, and get Dave to sign off on it.
So, yeah, there you go, Rob. I don't know if that answers your question, but I think broadly, sounds like a good idea, but probably, I mean, let's be honest, it's not going to be like that in practice, certainly at this moment in time. I can't imagine there are any products out there that are that fine-tuned or that efficient. I assume that in practice at the minute it's going to be pretty sloppy and pretty lazy, let's be honest. Any more news items? I know we
were
just talking about broader topics, but any news items from you chaps?
Well, I said not news. I don't think it's relatively new news, but it's something I stumbled on recently. And I wasn't aware. To be fair, I wasn't really aware of it, but it just never came across my radar. Are you aware that the United States are offering $10 million for cyber ransom as part of their Reward for Justice program? So if you know anybody who is... well, they're offering a reward for information leading to the identification or location of any person who, while acting under the direction or control of a foreign government, participates in malicious activities or cyber activities against the US critical infrastructure and a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So if anybody know of anybody dabbling in the area and want to make a quick $10 million before Christmas, I suggest you get in touch with the US, but I found that rather interesting.
It is interesting that. I think the one I read related it back to do we all remember when a particular group shut down the US pipeline, oil pipeline?
Yeah.
And it messed up their entire fuel supply. That's the one I read it was in relation to. So information that could lead to arrests in relation to that specific group, whatever they're called, Darktrace or something like that, some made up name. But no, very, very interesting.
But $10 million is, I'm sure they're taking it sufficiently serious, but I'm expecting they're going for the big boys, not some spotty 14-year-old in a bedroom outside of Wakefield.
Yeah, I did also see the one that Cameron's popped in the chat, which is that the Labour Party had a breach this week. Joe flagged that to us, saw it on Twitter earlier this week. He's very, very quick on the draw, I have to say, with our Joe on this one. I don't know if, because apparently it's in relation to a third party that they use, a third party supplier, but they've not named them. I know that the last time they had a breach, which was, we worked out, was last year, it was in relation to Blackboard, and they have had a couple of instances recently, so that could start to affect them. I don't know if either of you either saw that or read into it at all.
Which one? The last one?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a quick scan of it whilst I was over in Manchester this week. I saw it in the news, had a quick scan of it. I can't remember any particular detail. It didn't, yeah. But I did see it.
Yeah, I'd seen it. I hadn't really given it a great deal of reading at that point. Like Phil, I wasn't in Manchester, but I've been on the trains a bit this week. So I've not really had a great deal of chance to get caught up and read about it. So if there's anybody listening that wants to unmute and jump in and tell us all about it, feel free to take the floor for a little while and explain what's going on in that sense. So it's opening the floor up if anybody's interested.
Yes, by all means. Well, I'll tell you what, next time, Joe, when you're quick on the draw with a data breach, do some reading on it and you can fill us in on this session.
That's a good idea. I don't know if I told you what I was doing in Manchester. I've been doing a PCI report on compliance and assessment this week. And the company that we're assessing uses a data centre which is in an old Bank of England vault under the streets of Manchester, which is absolutely fascinating getting in there. So somewhere in the middle of Manchester, there's this data centre. And we went over, myself and Jamie, to assess the physical security of it. And, I mean, it's an amazing place. You know, the data centre itself, there's racks and racks and racks of servers behind this probably metre-thick steel door, which is a proper bank vault door you see out of all the gangster movies. And then you've got to go through a man-trap airlock-type thing with steel, you know, the see-through, like you're in jail, you know, see-through steel bar doors, you know, which one closes and you can't open the other one until the other one's closed. Really super secure, really impressive setup, actually. So I was doing that yesterday in Manchester, which was really, really interesting. But they used to store gold bullion in this thing. Then 20 years ago, it got turned into a data center. But it made me, and somebody reminded me of the data center I went to visit above a kebab shop on Dean Street in the central London once, and it's chalk and cheese. But that was quite interesting doing that PCI assessment. Anyway, sorry, I digressed there, Ollie.
No, it's very exotic, isn't it? It's nice to.
I'm not sure. Nice to I mean, you wouldn't want to work down there. You're in this concrete bunker all day. This is two guys on duty all the time, 24/7. You said you talked about this.
It'd be a little awkward if a bit of gold bullion went missing, wouldn't it?
Well, there's no bullion there anymore, sadly. It's just racks and racks of service. You said you talked about the Rolf and Oars last week. I don't know if there's anything that you want to talk on this week. So that came up in conversation this week. We had a meeting today, actually, earlier on in the day with the National Housing Federation, because we're working on the committee they're working on the Housing Code of Conduct. And Paul Bailey from the National Housing Federation was asking about this, or saying he'd seen this case in the in the news, which is interesting because, and if you've covered this off last week, then you know, shut me up and move on. But you know, the compensation claims come up for in a school setting where an email has gone off to the wrong parent with overdue fees information on it. But the judge looked at the harm that could have been caused by this and dismissed it out of hand and awarded the defendant's damages. So the people who brought the case, who were expecting to walk away with compensation, have lost the case and have had to pay damages, or will have to pay damages. But that's interesting because one of the things that we want to try and do is build out that kind of that framework for understanding how the compensation piece works. I was talking to another customer probably 3 weeks ago who said they'd had a request for compensation from a random person off the street, and they paid it out about, you know, £400 compensation. But I think all the evidence is moving towards, you know, no chance, you know, on your bike, you know. And here, for instance, Rolf and Oars is a case where, you know, there's precedent set and you've got to demonstrate a sufficient level of material or harm or distress. So there's been a few, hasn't there, cases on relating to compensation. And actually, that has, leads to the Vidal Hall and Google case is meant to get sorted next week, isn't it? I think that's slated for Wednesday.
Wednesday next week. I think it's 9:45 in the morning, isn't it?
I don't know, but that'll be interesting again. So all the evidence seems to be working in our favour, I think, in relation to compensation from data controllers' perspective.
Well, I think it's a fair judgment. Because the law doesn't say compensation is payable if the law is infringed. It is a harm-based approach, and therefore if you're going to have to demonstrate sufficient harm, your harm surely cannot be fanciful, and it can't be too remote and so on, as it would be with any other tort. So in that sense, I actually think it's probably a fair decision that it is kind of setting this de minimis level. We're not just going to be hang on a minute, we've not done this properly, here's £500. Because I don't think the law is necessarily there for that. I think you're looking at more than a minimal level of harm, and I think the case is probably quite fair on that point, personally.
Yeah, thanks, Bazad, for putting that link in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because the premise already exists in tort law, doesn't it, in common law, that you have to demonstrate a certain level of psychiatric injury to be able to claim damages for psychiatric harm. You can't just claim distress or that you're losing sleep. So it's good to see that cemented, because I've had clients who have had incredibly minor data breaches. For reference, without giving too much away, one of them was a housing provider, and they'd sent out an email to a block of residents, I think like 6 or 7 of them, and accidentally CC'd instead of BCC'd, classic. And one of them wrote back saying that this had caused him significant distress and he was entitled to a couple of grand for it. And you sort of think, crying out loud, like, come on. But yeah, no, yeah. It's good, it's good to see a development on that front.
Yeah, is it one of the typical human error things with Rolf and Oars? Because bizarrely, the email address that the fees statement got sent to was one character different from somebody else, you know, parents, the intended recipient. So, you know, it must have been like P. Brining rather than PA Brining at googlemail.com or something. So, human error again, isn't it?
Absolutely.
No, I think it is, yeah.
No, that's fine.
I saw an interesting, I'm just going to post it in the chat as well. Interesting, again, it's not particularly relevant, but this is something we touched on a few weeks ago. This is sort of this theory that, you know, given sufficient information around genetic information particularly, then anonymization is a flawed concept. So again, an article in Lexology where, you know, they're basically saying if you accumulate, you know, 2 or 3 data points, in fact, there's a 99.98% chance that anonymized individual data sets could be correctly identified using 15 demographic attributes. So, you know, you start think about how many demographic attributes get collected through social media, you know, and harvesting of data and scraping. It must be more than 15 demographic attributes. Therefore, what this is saying is that, you know, what you think is anonymized probably isn't. And given the development of AI, you know, there's going to be much more likelihood of being able to re-anonymize people in the future. So again, it's just something to think about, isn't it? Does anonymization actually work in practice?
A very interesting point, to be fair, because it's a bit of a tenuous link, but it's kind of that move to where if you're looking at personal data being identifiable, and people assume identity means you've got a name and address or something, as opposed to identifiable means that we can treat you differently from a different subset. So if we can don't necessarily need your name or any direct identifiers, but could we treat you differently to everybody else because of something that's unique about the information we hold or something, you know, in that kind of sense. So it's the identifiability that I think people tend to assume is mainly name and address, as opposed to just being able to, like with your cookie IDs or something or other, that we can target you and communicate or treat you differently because of what we know in that sense. And when you try to overlay that with anonymization, well, is anonymization ever fully achievable? But it's a very good kind of concept to kind of work through and think about.
For sure. I just wanted to pick up quickly, if that's all right, slight change of direction. But Dean had put a very interesting article in the chat about the fact the ICO has come out apparently this week and said that private communication channels used for official business by public authorities a court by for you. And they've reiterated that. So if you're exchanging WhatsApp messages relating to, you know, actual course of business matters as a public authority, then those messages can be caught by FOIA. Now, I know you two have worked probably far more on FOIA than I have, and I don't come at this from a public authority perspective, but I can only think that A, that's absolutely right, and B, a good thing. I don't know if either of you have got any thoughts on that, though.
I think I agree with you on both counts.
Because we cast our minds back, there was that whole debacle about what's private WhatsApp messages in relation to the, was it the health department, maybe?
There was some mid-government, yeah, I think there's also some government ministers using WhatsApp messages to communicate instead of official governmental channels, weren't they?
Yeah.
And there was concern that that might have possibly been outside of FOIA, and therefore you've got no ability to hold ministers to account.
Yeah, because fundamentally it's an oversight mechanism, right? So you shouldn't just be able to shift channels and say, well, that's it, you can't capture us anymore. It has to be caught. You know, so I can only think it's a good thing. Andrew's saying private message channels all down to retention, and also how would you know? So I guess you'd be touching on the control point if you were the governance team in that public authority, I guess, Andrew. I mean, you're welcome to come on and chat to us about it, but yeah, I mean, it must be an absolute nightmare for those that are trying to exert a bit of control as a governance, as part of the governance team in one of these public authorities, and turns out that everyone's messaging privately on WhatsApp. It seems we've just lost Phil, Dave, so let's crack on regardless.
It's possibly got too complicated for him.
Well, he's quickly deleting a load of WhatsApp messages by the sounds of it. Sorry, Andrew, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, it was just the thought. I mean, firstly, how would you ever know? And it was interesting, the speaker mentioned the government ministers using private means of avoiding people seeing and official records of what they're discussing. So, A, how would you know? But B, if indeed these are communications channels held by the public authority, it's all about retention, the same as emails and everything else. If your retention is short enough, the chances of it still being there when your FOI requested would be minimised and mitigated. You've got no requirement to keep the stuff. So nothing to stop people chatting, but they need to not retain what they wouldn't want finding out about.
Yeah, agreed. Well, it's I think someone's just made this point, actually. I think Tom's making the point that it's exactly the same in relation to subject access requests, ultimately, is that, you know, if you want to go and use any particular channel you want to use, then off you go. But do remember that whether it's in the context of personal data and DSARS or public authorities and the Freedom of Information Act, whatever you put in writing is potentially accessible. And it's often baffling to me that is still not quite understood completely by
a bit of a moot point, and I'd be interested to see people's thoughts on it. But if the organisation said you're not to use WhatsApp for communicating, and people used WhatsApp for communicating, would that make them, in essence, obviously if it's got personal data involved in looking at details, would that then make them a controller of that information, because they've been asked not to do it, so therefore if they're going to go off the bat and do it anyway, would it make them a controller of that piece of information through WhatsApp?
Yeah, actually that's the point that Tom's making. I hadn't read your point in full, Tom, apologies, but it's a very good one, which is that you, as the controller, would only have that, it's the offence under the Data Protection Act that you're referencing, isn't it, which is obtaining or retaining data without the consent of the controller. You'd only have that to rely on.
It highlights the fact that organisations need to have a control. And I know you don't necessarily know when people are doing it, and I know it might make it harder, but I think organisationally you should still, to a degree, have approved channels. So if you're going to communicate, these are the channels that you're going to communicate through, And these are the ones that we don't approve for official communications, whether it's commercially sensitive stuff, information relating to our customers or our suppliers and things. By all means, you might have a Teams or an employee or a social WhatsApp group saying, going out for drinks, we're meeting at this pub, that kind of thing. It's not trying to say WhatsApp's completely got to be avoided or other kind of software package like that's got to be avoided. But it's just putting control measures around saying what's acceptable and what isn't. Because it gives you something, at least a starting point from which to progress from, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what Emma's saying in that comment about setting sort of clear guidelines on that front. Andrew, I don't know if you want to jump in on anything in relation to that. Please do.
Well, it was only this is only ICO's opinion, of course. So if it push came to shove and you disagreed because you have no control over what individuals put on their private WhatsApp accounts, it'd be interesting what a tribunal's view would be, because I think you're sort of straying into sort of vicarious liability here. We're not liable for what an elected member puts on their own mobile device and WhatsApps to another elected member.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd argue it's nothing to do with us.
Well, yeah. Fair enough.
Well, anything for an easy life.
No, I love topics like this. I think it's fascinating. I love kicking them around.
Let's put the videos in a corner and ask the question and see how long the argument takes, isn't it?
Yeah. This is why we have this forum. No, I was going to say, the number of times I've had in private sector organisations, someone come to me and say we'd like to start using WhatsApp, or one I've had recently is the Facebook product Workplace, and they say, oh, it'll be brilliant, you know, we can communicate so much far more easily between one another, and potentially with tenants where it's social housing, etc. You go, be brilliant. You sort of go, yeah, but hang on a second, you really need to think about this, because this type of kit is so prone to being abused in terms of, you know, whether it's inappropriate contact or just storing things away or exchanging things you shouldn't, or, you know, basically just breaching the minimization principle, right, Dave? I don't know if that's something you've come across.
Well, there's that. I mean, I don't particularly like it. I think the organisations need to put control measures. I know you're not necessarily, there's probably harder to police, but I think they need some control measures around what people and what people can't do, because we've all seen standard kind of policy documents saying that you can't use abusive language or cause offences through using equipment and bits and pieces. So why would you then if you're not careful, facilitate people driving themselves to other channels that you've not got sight of, where that activity could be happening in that sense. So I would, and I know it's difficult, I know it's a very difficult point to kind of, well, how do you control it? How do you police it? But surely the starting point is, if it's organisational information or it's customer information or it's derogatory or it's anything going against organisational values, you shouldn't be doing it. In that sense, as a simple guide, I get the policing point, but I still think you need to start from the point of setting the scene that you shouldn't be using or having platforms where you can spread. I mean, I know when you're talking commercially sensitive information or potentially data subject information and so on, but the same channels, if it's not police, could be used to still spread misinformation, could still be used to spread discrimination and so on, forms of organisational abuse or bullying and such forth and so on. So I think you've got acceptable use policies. I think we need to make sure that, yes, there's an element that we can't police it, but we can't just say we can't police it. We're going to ignore it. I still think if there's an element we can't police it, but we should still be having a policy saying we've got an acceptable use policy. We shouldn't be using channels for commercially sensitive stuff. We shouldn't be using it for personal data on our customers, or likewise, we certainly shouldn't be using it for discriminatory or other means that may go against organisational principles or just general principles of society. Let's be fair, discrimination really isn't a thing that should be acceptable nowadays.
No, quite right. Andrew?
I wouldn't disagree with the sentiments of that, but there's a tension here, isn't there, where such unacceptable behaviour is performed on your authority's equipment and where such behaviour and content is performed on personally owned, nothing to do with the authority equipment. And it's all very well the ICO saying it's all captured, at some point somebody becomes a private individual and not part of the authority, and that's the moot point. That's the arguable issue upon which a decision ultimately would turn. And you can't stop people. You know, what is the difference between two people having a WhatsApp conversation on their personal mobiles and having a telephone call on their personal mobiles? You can't control either, and you can't know that either are taking place or access what was taking place. So there has to be a point where you've got an acceptable behaviour. If that behaviour is exceeded, you've got policies to deal with it. And if people go outside of that and bring your organisation into disrepute or breach laws in relation to unlawful disclosures, retention, whatever else, you have to revert to the law and say, we're reporting this because it's our data you're mishandling, and you're on your own, Jack, because we've told you you can't do this.
For sure. It's a very valid point. Absolutely. That it's you can only go so far. There's still the policing point of how do you know it's happening until somebody brings it to your attention, because you can't. It would certainly be an overstretch of authority to start checking people's phones randomly just to make sure that they've not got stuff within private chats that you're not happy with. So you've got a very valid point around how do you police and how do you manage it. But it comes back to that point of, well, we need something in place, the policies, procedures, the acceptable use guide, guidance, and so on, and then just deal with it through the law if anything does come to light.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I think it's a very valid point.
It's a fascinating topic. I don't deal too much with our public sector clients, so it's always interesting for me to get a view of what the other side of the coin might hold, I suppose, on that front.
It's a bit of a tenuous link, not trying to move on too much, but just a bit of a tenuous link, because somebody had mentioned subject access requests. Did you come across recently a publication by the Swedish Data Protection Authority? It was, I've only just kind of come across it, but it was made about 10th of September, and it was in relation to SARS, and in particular about whether a subject access request could be received via a tweet on Twitter to the company's website. So I don't know if anybody's come across that or if you've come across that. Now, it's one that doesn't necessarily sit perfectly well, because the Swedish, unfortunately, didn't really give an example. It didn't really kind of answer the question. So the facts are that the individual purchased a product from the controller and then started receiving promotional SMS messages to inscribe from the SMS. Required sending an SMS to a foreign number, which the individual didn't want to do because of costs and so on. So he basically tweeted the company asking for his information to be deleted. They initially didn't do anything. He received another SMS, so he went ahead and issued the tweet again, and then ultimately his data was deleted. So he kind of got that far, but the Swedish Data Protection Authority doesn't explicitly comment on the issue at hand, but the reasoning that was in there kind of gave an indication that it is possibly not. So it says the assessment suggests a certain tendency not to understand tweets as the exercise of a data subject right in that sense. And I just wondered whether anybody had kind of come across that, because the ICO in the UK has been quite clear that SARS can be made verbally or in writing, including via social media. So there seems to be a kind of friction between what the ICO has potentially said as valid route for SARS, because there's no formal application for them nowadays. And yet the Swedes have kind of taken this kind of, not really answered it, but not but kind of through their direction kind of indicated that it's possibly not the way to do it through Twitter.
Yeah, I think arguably in this day and age, in the digital age, there's sort of no reason why that would not be a valid channel. I mean, I know that you essentially have almost unfettered access to some poor social media person on the company's end that you could bombard in theory, so I can kind of get an argument on that front, but really I don't know why you wouldn't sort of respect that, at least in theory. Andrew, sorry, did you want to chip in on that?
Yeah, There's two angles. If you can remind me to go back to third party SARs at the end, but yeah, receiving something on social media is not as much of an issue as the help that you're given by Recital 63 and 64 in terms of the right to access and verification of identity, which you can't easily do through social media. So we would treat something like that, if it indeed got to us, as an initial inquiry, but it's not a fully compliant request because we don't know who's asking and we have no validation of their ID. So we would go back through our normal channels and say, this is the email address. Come to us on this because we're going to need this, 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 and this to satisfy ourselves that you are who you are. But that sort of triggers memory of we're receiving, I don't know if other people in this chat are receiving, SAR requests through a portal, a bit like the FOI portal, who do you think they are or what do they know, whatever it's called. And again, you've got no idea who is making the request, and you need to be satisfied that it is the data subject. So we divert the incoming and respond to the email address that is linked in it and go back to the applicant directly. And we will not respond through an unidentified portal that goes to wherever, which also means we've got to log on to a portal that we are not sure of the security of in relation to our own infrastructure. But it's a growing, you know, why would anybody need to go to a portal to ask me what our authority know about them when they can come to us directly and ask the same question and get an answer?
No, I'm completely in agreement with you on that. Some of my clients have started receiving a lot of these. There's something called PrivacyBee, I think, which is an American platform. Basically allows you to load up your details and basically blast out requests to anyone you've ever interacted with, and pump out these erasure requests or access requests. I think, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong on this, or Andrew, if I'm right, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the latest SAR guidance from the ICO says that if it's made through a portal, then it can still be valid, but you don't need to go through, you basically don't need to jump through hoops excessively. If it's asking you to sort of log in and do all sorts, then in theory you're entitled to push back on that, I believe.
Yeah, we don't take the approach that they're not valid. We just won't reply through the method that they've contacted us.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in. I agree with you. I think there's a difference between receiving it. If you've received it through a portal, how do you know that the email has come to you from the owner of that email? So if they said, can you please delete all the information relating to me, and you did, then how do you know that's not somebody's from a compromised email account?
Precisely.
In that sense. So I think there's that element of it. So by all means, you could say, well, actually receiving it by Twitter is valid. And as Andrew's pointed out, you'd still go through, well, we've received this. Was this you or was it made maliciously in that sense? And whether you need to do any further formal assessment around that, as opposed to just accepting that we've received an email and we're going to go ahead straight ahead and delete it. And then there's a portal element, which is slightly different, isn't it? Where if it's asking the controller to kind of logging up here or do bits and pieces, that's overly onerous. There's an element of that, but that's not necessarily the same point as what Andrew's picking up on.
For sure. No, it's very interesting. It's always good to share experiences on this front. I just wanted to switch gears very quickly, Dave, if that's all right. There's loads of stuff in the chat, and I'm sorry I can't get to it all. We always do this. We always encourage interaction because we're worried that people won't, and then we really get taken up on it, which is lovely to see. There's one point, I think, from Vicky I wanted to cover, because there's a slight change of gears, and I think we've got time for this, just to talk about it. And so I wanted to come to you on this, Dave, if that's all right. But essentially, Vicky's asking about, effectively, as an education provider, employing a third-party platform who are a controller and essentially loading up the names of the students to help them. I guess it's career guidance, effectively, or further study guidance, and loading up their information and sort of send them off and getting them a link and they can log in and then apply for courses and that sort of thing, from what I understand. But in terms of setting that up, in terms of your responsibilities as let's call it the initial controller, for want of a better term, What do you think are your responsibilities in relation to that? What do you need to put in place? Because it's not like a process that you don't necessarily have your Article 28 obligations, but you will still have a degree of responsibility, if anything, purely from an education provider's perspective to look after your students. What are some of the things maybe, Dave, that you would look at and think about putting in place to sort of prepare for that?
So you're talking about the university working with a supplier, working with a platform that that the students use for managing their courses. And you mentioned that platform indicates that they're a controller, so it's a controller to controller, whether joint or independent controller controller relationship. Is that the bit that you're looking at?
Effectively, so I guess there's a two-part thing to this, which is what do you need to think about if you're a controller potentially looking to start supplying data to another controller? So that's one aspect of it. What sort of due diligence might you do? What sort of agreements or terms might you want to have in place? And the second half, I guess, is there any difference there because you are an educational institution and you are looking after children, it's children's data, even if they're school leaver age, whether that makes a difference at all. Then you got any thoughts on that, Dave?
Yeah, well, I think naturally if it involves children or individuals that could be at risk or vulnerabilities and things, I think it naturally means there's going to be a high level of due diligence involved, just because it's children, because the sensitivities around children. Not necessarily saying it's going to stop you doing it, but whenever there's children's data involved, I always get a little bit cautious because the sensitivities around it. And that's probably why I'm exercising the caution here. If you're looking at, as a controller, trying to work out whether you want to do this activity with another controller, I would certainly be saying there's some due diligence. You'd have to understand what they're offering, why would that benefit you, the relationships between the two of you, the types of information that will be shared, how it will be shared, potentially if it's where it's going to be shared. Is it going to be, a provider that's US-based, for example? There must be alternatives around using one platform or using one organisation to another. They might have competitors out there, so why have we gone to that particular one and not others? So what are the benefits? What benefits does that particular provider offer, or that particular organisation offer, that its competitors don't, unless it's the only one in the market? So I would certainly be looking, doing due diligence around those kind of bits. Ultimately, if you're looking at sharing with them, I would have said that, not saying there's hierarchy between controllers, but you're the primary controller in that sense, I would have argued, because you're the one who's initiating the controlling and the information sharing. So I would certainly be considering relevant factors around that, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Rachel adding to that they would be undertaking a DPIA and asking for a data sharing agreement, which DPIA 100%,
The DPIA 100%, because if it's classed as high risk, mandatorily, then you're caught by the requirements of doing a DPIA. But the ICO's guidance on data sharing suggests it's even best practice, even if it's not deemed to be high risk. It's best practice to undertake a DPIA for data sharing purposes. Absolutely look at doing a DPIA on there. And if it is a controller-to-controller relationship, make sure that you've got appropriate documented agreement in place, purely because if things are documented, it's easier to demonstrate responsibilities as opposed to not having it documented.
Yeah, and I tell you one other thing maybe that I would add on this, which is something I've started to emphasise with my education-based clients, is even if it's not necessarily from a pure, strict interpretation of the law, even if it's not necessarily your responsibility, I would still be asking that provider to provide some assurances around their compliance with the Children's Code, because by the sounds of it, the product you've described, the system you described, is going to be caught, and I think their status of compliance with that code probably tells you quite a lot about their standards as an organisation. Because if they come to you and say, well, we've never heard of it, then obviously they're going to sound like a bunch of cowboys. But obviously there can, be a huge spectrum with, between that and actually being fully compliant and having implemented or the controls, maybe they're carrying out their assessment and they're, you know, implementing changes as we go, and that may be sufficient depending on the nature of the changes they're making. I don't know. But I certainly ask for some assurances just to give you a feel, I guess, more than anything for the organisation.
Just on that one, I would also, without trying to make data protection rather onerous, I would agree, I would certainly asking them, I'm not making a determination at this point either whether they are caught or not caught by ADCOP, but I would certainly be asking them whether they are, and can you see the justification of whether they feel that they are caught or they're not caught, because whether they are or they're not, they should arguably be able to demonstrate their justifications for either, quite frankly. So if they're not caught, well, why aren't you caught? And if you are caught, why are you caught, ultimately? So they've got something to fall back on. Very similar to the approach that we take with whether you're caught by the requirements of having a DPO or not. Well, have you got the justification? Well, we don't need a DPO. Well, that's fine. You maybe don't need a DPO, but can you demonstrate that thought process? Can you demonstrate why you don't meet the requirements? And then to keep that for accountability. So I'd certainly be looking for that element to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I hope that helps you, Vicky. With your issues there, we've got a couple of minutes, so there's one last, there's loads in the chat, and I do apologise, I didn't manage to get to it all, but there's some really great conversations happening in there in relation to particularly SARs that are received through a portal. It's very interesting. I guess we might do another SARs session in future. I'm sure there'll be sure that might be of interest to some. That's something that we could possibly talk about in greater detail.
That would be, just before you go on to the last thing, just on the SARs, I think that would be useful if we can, because the DCMS on their consultations brought out, or in part their public consultation, is looking to change, or potentially change, how DSARs are handled. And so on. So I think whether we have one just on what the DCMS's proposals are and what the ICO's response to those proposals are, specifically around DSARs, or whether we time it and look to covering that off once the consultation process has been completed and we get some kind of clear direction as to any potential changes that are going to be made, because that might be quite fundamental for some organisations. Depending whether, like I said, depending on if changes are made as a result of the consultation process.
Yeah, well, funny you should mention that, because our very own Phil Brining is currently writing up a white paper on the proposed changes to SARs that he's looking to have ready for PrivSec, where we will be on the 16th. So if that's of interest to anyone, do give us a shout. We're almost out of time for this week. There's a couple of other bits in the chat there. There's one just quickly I wanted to pick up on because I saw an interesting stat that sort of relates to it. Cameron's popped in a link about the new surveillance powers available to Australian law enforcement. If you want to come on, Cameron, and talk about that, please do. The only reason I raise it is a very, very tenuous segue, but I saw quite an interesting piece on the BBC talking about the extent to which people are subject to surveillance when working from home, surveillance from their employers. And apparently there was a survey run or a piece of work run by a particular charity, the name of which I forget, I apologise. But one of the stats they turned up, quite startling. They're saying that according to them, up to 48% of people aged 18 to 34 might be systematically monitored by their employer when working from home, which is astronomical, do you not think, Dave?
So that's, again,
they reckon if you're aged between 18 and 34-year-olds, up to 48% of them are being systematically monitored when they work from home by their employers, which is damning.
I feel a bit let down by Phil if we're doing that, because I'm older than the age bracket. So does that mean Phil's not interested in me anymore?
Quick question for me, it's Cam. Is that monitoring in terms of like lawful business monitoring, or is it, when you say systematic monitoring, is that that they're just be constantly being monitored in terms of their performance and their actual work activity?
No, from the sounds of it, it sounds like it's A, that, and then B, it goes beyond it, so that it's just if you pull up a YouTube video at 6 o'clock in the evening, then they're still locked in. There was a testimony for a guy who was working for a, I think it was software development, And he was saying that he came into the office one day while everyone was working from home and only the managers were in, and all the screens in the office were turned on and he could see everyone else's screens and they were just watching him. Which is very, I mean, on the age bracket thing, it feels really quite condescending, doesn't it? That there's sort of this assumption that younger people maybe can't be trusted. Well, some may feel differently, some may feel that's justified, but yeah, it's quite shocking really, isn't it?
I'll add it to my list next time I have a one-to-one with Phil to see what he's looking at.
Yeah.
Because well, I think you're squarely caught and I'm not. So I don't know what he's interested in.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, on that note, we are out of time.
I was just going to say a very quick one. It's not a massive talking point. It's just one thing I've come across. Obviously, there's a change in the ICO with Elizabeth Denham leaving. I've seen something. Do correct me if I'm wrong. I think she leaves at the end of November, but John doesn't start. My mate John doesn't start until January. So I'm not quite sure what that means for the riddleless month of Christmas. But that's the final bit for me that I've seen this week.
Oh, interesting. So it sounds like data protection all goes out the window over Christmas. Lovely. Do what we want. Okay. No, but
we welcome John. We welcome John when he's over. It'll be useful to see the direction that he takes in light of the DCMS.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Looking forward to that. So let's leave it at that for now because we're already a couple minutes over. So thank you very much, Dave, for all of your contributions on this. Thanks, Phil, who had to dive off, unfortunately, halfway through. Thank you to everyone on the session. All your contributions are absolutely wonderful. We really, really love our little community that comes together every week to discuss these topics. It's absolutely fantastic to kick these ideas around and just share some knowledge and some insights. So we absolutely love that. Some really great topics today, and hopefully we'll have many more in future. Next week we are back with I'm not entirely sure what the event is next week. Mark, could you jog my memory, please?
Sorry, Ollie. I was just on mute there. Yeah, I am present. I'm still here. Next week, I believe we've got Rob's event, which is, just bear with me a second. We've got 6 years in social housing. So I look back at the last 6 years of our organisation working with organisations in the social housing sector. So it should be a real busy one, obviously, that with that being sort of one of our main audiences, really.
Excellent. Really looking forward to that. That'll be fantastic. And then
I'm also looking forward to working within the prison service, because if we can say 10 years of being in prison would have been quite an interesting topic.
Indeed.
But yeah, we will be back with another Open Surgery the week thereafter, another episode of GDPR Radio. So if there's anything that we've either not covered today or not covered sufficiently, then hold on to your questions for a couple of weeks and we'll get back to them. Or if there's anything that desperately you need to talk to us about in the meantime, support@dataprotectionpeople.com, drop us an email and we'll see what we can do. But otherwise, thank you all for attending. As ever, have an absolutely lovely weekend and we'll catch up with you next week.
Yeah, no, great. Thank you, everybody. It's been great spending a bit of time with you. Take care for now. Have a great weekend.